Tonight on Canton Confidential, we are diving into the depths of the Karen Reed murder trial.
We're happy that we have a jury.
After a week of intense scrutiny and hundreds of jurors vetted, the stage is set.
We're looking forward to starting.
Yet, this is just the beginning. As lawyers brace for fiery opening statements on Monday, outside the courtroom, the case continues to ignite profound emotions.
How's it feel to be a cop killer, Karen?
Shame on you!
Free Karen!
We're breaking it all down for you right now on Canton Confidential, the Karen Reed murder trial.
Thank you for being with us, everyone. I'm J.C. Monahan.
And I'm Glenn Jones. The jury that will decide the fate of Karen Reed has officially been seated, and opening statements are set for Monday morning. But tonight, there are still a few details that need to be hashed out, starting with the jury.
So right now, there are more jurors than there are seats in the jury box. So over the next few days, 12 of the 19 people will be sworn in and given a seat. Four others will be sworn in to serve as alternates. The remaining three people, we'll have to get to that in a little later, because it gets a little confusing when the number gets as high as 19.
We'll have to explain that. Let's have NBC 10's Kirsten Glavin join the Canton Confidential conversation now. Kirsten, take us through the final day of jury selection.
Well, guys, it took a long 5 days to get to this point, but we do officially have a seated jury for the Karen Reed murder trial. Now, today, five jurors were taken away. Five more were added, so we're back up to that 19 jurors. At the end of the day, we're going to have 16 move forward with this trial at this point. And in the coming days, they will be sworn in. So it's going to be a very long road ahead for all of those selected.
A jury now set for the highly anticipated Karen Reed murder trial. 19 jurors currently seated, with three still expected to drop before testimony begins on Monday.
How are you feeling about the jury selection so far?
We're very pleased. Yeah, we're happy that we have a jury, and we're looking forward to starting.
Attorneys for Reed now focused on next week.
I'm excited. Finally, we're going to get this thing off the ground. I'm happy to have a jury. I'm happy that that we're finally getting to the evidence, to the heart of the matter.
During jury selection on Wednesday, out of 85 potential jurors, 60 raising their hands saying they've heard of the case, 28 forming an opinion, and 7 admitting a bias. Judge Beverly Cannoni saying she will consider moving the trial.
In order to advance to the merits of this case without further delay or collateral distraction, I will consider moving the trial across the hall to courtroom 25.
This after Reed's defense team raised concerns over the layout of the current courtroom, stating some jurors wouldn't be able to see the witnesses' demeanor and facial expressions. NBC 10's legal analyst Michael Coyne says it's common to have constraints on how many people can sit in.
All of our courtrooms in the Commonwealth and virtually everywhere have limitations on the number of people who can actually attend that trial. It happened in the Bulger trial. It happened in the Hernandez trial. It happens quite regularly that we can't seat everyone who wants to be present.
Also filed Wednesday, a notice of discovery from Reed's defense, including video from the Canton Police Department's Sally Port and a copy of a Massachusetts State Police report.
How does it feel? Known as a cop killer.
On her way into court, one self-proclaimed YouTuber calling Reed a cop killer.
Shame on you, Karen.
With a lengthy trial ahead, Coyne telling us he believes the Commonwealth will have a hard time with their burden of proof.
This is not a second-degree murder case at all. Sis, I don't think you've got the evidence of intent. They had some troubles in their relationship. Yeah, join the club.
Now, tomorrow morning, there is another hearing scheduled for a lot of the outstanding motions that the judge has yet to rule on. So more to come from that. Glenn?
Kirsten, one of those outstanding things is what she ultimately decides about moving the case across the hall. Do we know when she'll make that call? And if it does move across the hall, what's different about this new courtroom that would satisfy the questions we have with the old one?
Well, Well, Glenn, I can tell you I was in that other courtroom just yesterday. Aidan Kearney, otherwise known as Turtle Boy, had a hearing there. So we did get to sit in, and it is much smaller than where we've been having jury selection. So that is going to be the main thing we're going to see. In terms of how many people can get inside and actually be seated, it sounds like it's going to be mainly press and those involved in the case. So some changes will come from that. But the judge, again, is going to be considering that tomorrow morning. She doesn't have to make a decision just yet. She can take that under advisement, as well as the other motions that she'll be looking at as well. So it's going to be interesting to see what decisions, if any, are made tomorrow. But that is something that's going to be discussed, and we'll make sure to stay on top of that as well, because those changes could affect a lot of people who are interested in watching and following along with this high-profile case.
Kirsten, thank you very much. Let's take a deeper dive into the jury selection process. We want to bring in David Davis. He's been a Cambridge-based jury consultant for 35 years. David, thank you very much for spending this time with us. I need some clarification. First off, why are there more potential jurors being considered in this trial than usual?
Well, this is a long case, and one of the very worst things that can happen in a trial is you end up losing a bunch of jurors, and you have to say, this is a mistrial, start the whole thing over again. So I think the judge wants to be really, really sure that there's going to be enough jurors by the time they get to deliberate. And I also understand that there's some jurors that may have indicated that they might have some hardships, and that there's also something that has to be taken into account. And lastly, I've just been on so many trials where a jury gets seated and then the weekend goes by and they're getting ready to do the opening statements, and a jury will come to the judge and say, you know, I forgot to tell you, I just remembered that I do have a vacation in 2 weeks, so I'm going to have to be away then. And so jurors drop. They get sick during the course of the trial, emergencies come up, and I think the judge just wants to be really, really sure that there are going to be enough jurors at the end.
Okay, David, you touched on just two points. I just want to clarify if you can help me, because we know the prosecution and the defense have an idea of what type of person they want on the jury. But with that total number changing, I mean, it was previously they wanted 20, no, make that 19. And as you just mentioned, some may drop out. So how challenging is that for both sides to make sure that they have the people that they want in that jury box?
Well, what I don't know is if three jurors are going to be dropped from, that the judge will allow each side to strike the jurors, and therefore they're going to have to take into account all the things they know about that juror and whether they think they're going to be good for them or not.
David, can you just touch on the hardship claim? Because what actually constitutes a hardship? A vacation, for example, you know, I wouldn't consider that a hardship. That's a sacrifice. But is that considered a hardship?
Well, everything is up to the judge's discretion. Different judges are stricter than other judges. But most judges, in my experience, if a juror says that they have bought tickets to a vacation and those tickets are non-refundable, or they're going to a wedding and the wedding can't be rescheduled, then most judges will excuse a juror for that reason. The other biggest reason is the juror says that he or she will experience financial hardship, maybe because they're self-employed or they're unemployed and they're looking for a job. Lots of jurors think they can get out of jury duty by saying it's going to be a hardship on the place where they work because they have a big project that they have to finish. And there's not many judges that are sympathetic to that excuse. Other reasons might be because the juror is involved in childcare, they have to take their kids to school in the morning and pick them up in the evening. Pardon me. Or it could be that they're caring for someone who's sick or disabled. And that's typically a reason why a juror would be excused for hardship.
It does sound like a very fluid definition then, based on the judge in the case. David Davis, thank you so much for joining us tonight. You really helped explain a number of issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay, JC, we are just in the early stages of this trial. In fact, it hasn't even really started yet, but already emotions are running high outside the courthouse. This morning, instead of being greeted by supporters, Reed and her defense team were heckled as they walked into the court.
Will you denounce your supporters harassing the Keefe family? Will you denounce...
It's pretty clear that this is the kind of thing that could grow into a circus-like atmosphere. Sue O'Connell is here with us now after another day inside the courtroom. But let's start our conversation outside the courtroom. Yeah. And this is something that you've been warning about throughout. Of course, there is a buffer zone mm-hmm. around the courthouse. It was my understanding that that applied equally to both sides in this argument. So, in fairness, I think that shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, so, Glenn, you hit on an important point. I mean, first of all, Karen Reed deserves a fair trial.
Absolutely.
She deserves a fair trial, and John O'Keefe deserves justice. And the way he'll get justice is through Karen Reed getting a fair trial.
Right.
And the ruling here was not only protesters can't carry signs, but also police officers could not wear, law enforcement could not wear uniforms in the courtroom during the trial so that they might also influence the jury, perhaps intentionally or not, in the other way. But the way the ruling was written was not necessarily that someone couldn't come up and yell at someone or say something like that. I mean, and that's what the challenge here is. I think behavior like this that happened this morning, and, you know, it's one thing to see the video of it, but people who were out there when that happened, it was scary because this person is an agitator. This person, we are hearing, allegedly comes from another state. So
it sounded very aggressive.
And it was very aggressive. Again, remember, she's innocent until proven guilty. And if something happened to her on the way into the courthouse, besides the fact that would not be a good thing from a moral standpoint, it might impact the trial. So I don't know what's going to happen next. Some people have been talking about the fact that she keeps getting dropped off on the side of the courthouse with her law team and then has to walk around the corner to come up the front steps. Maybe there should be some law enforcement there to make sure she's not attacked or heckled, or anybody is attacked or heckled. But this is exactly what the judge has been concerned about with this, putting this buffer zone in place so that jurors and people involved in the trial are not only, you know, influenced, which I'm not sure if that's really going to happen to someone, but are not in feeling any danger or feel like they have to be a hero in order to serve jury or in order to go into the courtroom.
Let's talk about the buffer zone for a moment, because there is a chance the SJC decides to overturn the buffer mm-hmm. zone, and then what? What do you imagine the atmosphere is like outside of court without a buffer zone?
Right. So if there's no buffer zone, then you have to have a higher police presence, state police, in order to escort people into the building, both in the back of the building and the side of the building, wherever the jurors are coming from, and also any of the witnesses that are coming in. They'll need to be escorted in, because then you'll have more of a crowd there. Now, certainly, people are exercising their right to free speech. People are not wearing signs. Some people are wearing pink, and some of those people are wearing pink to support Karen Reed. All understandable. But if there's no buffer zone sort of controlling the area, then what we're going to have is a greater police presence. Listen, the right to free speech has a lot of contingencies on the right to free speech. We just can't do and say whatever we want. That's right. Not what the Constitution
like yelling
says.
Fire in a crowded building. Can't do that.
It. And the constitutional right to a free and fair trial is utmost in our Constitution. So protecting her right, Karen Reed's right, to get a free trial, a fair trial, is going to be what I think the Supreme Court justices are going to be looking at when they make this decision.
All right. There's a lot to be sorted out before we get to opening statements on Monday. Thank you very much, Sue O'Connell. We are waiting for the judge to rule on several big motions that will have a huge impact on this trial. The jury will be sworn in soon, and we are expecting opening statements once again to begin on Monday.
And of course, at every turn, we will continue to bring you complete coverage of the day's biggest moments right here on NBC 10 Boston News at 7. You can also catch up on anything you may have missed by watching full episodes of Canton Confidential on our website, or listening to our podcast on your favorite platform.